Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. How are you?
I'm jet-lagged. Thank you very much.
I'm not surprised, because it feels like you've basically been on the road since the 2nd of January.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit like that.
I'm trying to remember. Is it like three trips you've done now to North America this year?
Indeed. So Montreal at -26 degrees, and
wow.
I've been to Sacramento and San Francisco.
Which is quite impressive given we're barely into the year.
Yes, I seem to have spent most of 2026 so far either on a plane or wearing a lanyard talking about the drinks industry.
So not seeing much of the lovely places you're visiting then?
Sadly, no. My sister always tells me that she envies my travel, and I tell her she can have exactly the same experience by hanging out in a conference room.
Wearing a lanyard.
But that's my life. Let's talk about your life, your sabbatical through the Caribbean. How's that going?
It is going very, very well, thank you, although primarily it's been Central America.
Well, how would any of us know? Because from the very small number of photographs you've shared, it looks suspiciously like one cocktail after another.
That's a completely unfair characterisation, Felicity.
Is it?
It's purely anthropological drinks research.
That's a tough assignment you've taken on there, Lily.
Yeah, very tough. Somebody's got to do it. Anyway, before I get more embarrassed, I'm going to take us back to today's episode. So normally on A Question of Drinks, we take one question about the drinks world and examine it in, shall we say, rather a lot of detail.
That's right. No question too big or too small.
So we did now get some lovely feedback from some of our listeners about those deep dives episodes. And they say, yay, great. But after our end of year episode, do you remember at the end of 2025, we looked at several of the biggest stories of the year. And one listener wrote in to say he particularly liked that format because it was, and I quote him, more digestible.
I guess it's easier to listen to multiple chunks rather than one big long story.
Okay, I think, yes, that's a polite way of putting it, exactly. Anyway, and what's interesting is that when you put those stories side by side, you start to see patterns. So we thought we'd try doing this kind of episode sort of every couple of months, mix it in.
Yes, but we're not abandoning deep dives. No. I'm still quite wedded to the idea of doing Freakonomics styles looks at drinks.
Yeah, exactly. So those are interesting too. But every now and then we're going to do a sort of drinks industry news roundup where we bring in a few of the big stories that we think matter.
And some that are just silly, chosen by me.
Yes, of course. So in today's episode, we've each picked out some of the most interesting stories in global drinks so far in 2026.
Right. So why don't you kick us off, Luli? What's your first story pick?
Okay, right. So first story, we're starting with the world's largest spirits company, Diageo, and its new CEO, Sir Dave Lewis. Now, you remember a few episodes ago, we talked about Lewis being appointed and you commented on the nickname the press had given him, Drastic Dave.
Yeah, I wondered how his parents felt about it.
Quite. Because for anyone who missed that episode, the nickname actually dates back to Lewis's time running Tesco, where the business press started calling him Drastic Dave rather because of the sort of rather decisive way he approached turning the company around.
Yeah, put it this way, they might have called him Decapitation Dave.
Maybe they should have done, exactly. And we may now be seeing exactly that why that nickname exists. So in his first major results presentation to investors as CEO of Diageo, Lewis delivered a message that kind of landed like a small earthquake, really, in the drinks industry.
Yeah, so first up, kudos to him for getting a handle on a whole industry when he'd only been in the place for 7 weeks. I read that he just spent the time going from place to place via plane. And also, kudos for not mincing words and then for publishing his speech for anybody to read.
Yeah, and I guess that's what comes when you're sort of very early into your term as a CEO. You've kind of got that one chance, haven't you, to sort of, sort of draw a line under where the business is. But what stood out for you?
And he's drawn a line.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah, so what stood out for you?
Basically, in his speech, he told everybody that Diageo as a company was bloated and inefficient. Mm. He said, and check this, 60% of all orders that Diageo gets have to be entered manually.
Wow.
I mean, this is a global company with multiple offices, so you can imagine. And also that it had a ridiculously expensive payroll. It was 10 times higher than at his last place. So I guess he's sharpening his axe.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was a second thing, wasn't there, around the North America.
Yeah, he said customer service in North America was woeful. He said, and I quote, "Our customer service in the off-trade is frankly really very poor," which is English for terrible, terrible.
Yeah.
"I have shared with you here the customer service levels I experienced in North America, Latin America and the UK, and they are really not acceptable." So he's a straight talker.
He is, yes. And then the third big thing he talked about?
Well, he was blunt. He said Diageo is lacking in innovation. He said there were lots of small projects going on, but they all lacked impact. Now, this is interesting because the earlier executive team wound down their innovation arm, Distill Ventures, in March 2025.
Yeah, they did. And it was the world's first spirit sort of accelerator, wasn't it? Business accelerator, founded in 2013. So over the years, they put more than $45 million into sort of 33 incubator businesses. And interestingly, I had the pleasure of attending a dinner they hosted in 2024, actually, where I met some of the amazing founders they were supporting, and including two amazing female founders in Australia who had founded a rum that was using sort of indigenous nuts as part of the flavour profile, which was very interesting. But what big brands did they kind of invest in?
Well, this is the issue. They had lots of little interesting brands, but only two big breakthrough ones. So they bought into Seedlip early on. That's the non-alc version of gin that helped to kickstart the whole non-alc segment. So I guess you could call that one category defining. They also had Mr. Black, which is an Australian coffee liqueur that was the fastest growing brand in the coffee liqueur category when they bought it. And apart from that, it was a handful of craft brands.
Mm. Yeah, which kind of goes to show, doesn't it, that creating breakthrough drink brands, it really isn't easy, even with the money and the marketing skill, you know, with Diageo behind you. But that brings me back to the thing that really struck me most, I would say, about Dave Lewis's presentation.
Sir Dave Lewis,
Drastic Dave's presentation. Something that was really interesting to hear from the world's largest spirits company. So for the last decade or so, the dominant strategy across the spirits industry, particularly well, drinks, overall, but spirits specifically, has been the word premiumization. So fewer bottles, but sell them at higher prices.
Yeah. And that worked very nicely for a long time.
It did. And particularly during COVID, when people were drinking more at home and trading up. And Diageo was one of the companies that really benefited from that trend. So their portfolio is basically sort of a roll call of some of the biggest drinks brands, spirits brands in the world. So they own Johnnie Walker, Smirnoff, Tanqueray, Gordon's, Captain Morgan, Don Julio, Casamigos, Bailey's, Ketel One, etc.
Yeah, so in other words, they pretty much dominate the shelf.
Yeah, and the back bar as well. And outside of spirits, they own Guinness, which we've talked about before, which is one of the most valuable beer brands globally and currently one of the fastest growing, particularly with the Guinness Zero as well.
So in other words, the point of this is that when Diageo says something about the market, it's worth listening to it.
Exactly, exactly. And what Lewis told investors was striking, as you said earlier. So during his presentation, he said, and I quote here, "There's a whole bunch of people at the moment who are not enjoying a brand from Diageo in our core categories, and that is an opportunity for us."
Yeah, he basically said that Diageo had ignored a huge segment of the market.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And he backed that up, you know, with some rather interesting data. So Lewis said 31% of Diageo's spirit sales in the US are priced above $45, whereas the market average is around 21% being priced above that, yeah.
Yeah, so they're overweighted at the expensive end of the market.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And he told investors the key issue right now is what he described as, again, quote, pressurized consumer wallets.
pressurized consumer wallets, and they gave this guy a knighthood. I think they should take it away. I mean, I guess what he means in English is people are broke.
Exactly, exactly. And the market reaction
pressurized
suggests...
consumer wallets.
Are you not going to use that phrase now?
I'm going to use that now with category entry points.
We're going to come on to those.
Yes,
we'll come on to that. Don't you worry. So exactly. So the market reaction, as I was saying, suggests investors were not entirely reassured. So the results included cutting the dividend in half. And after the announcement, Diageo's share price fell roughly sort of 10 to 13% in a single day.
I bet there was a sharp intake of breath on the call when he announced the dividend cutting.
Yeah. But again, as I say, you know, new CEO coming in, that's your kind of big chance to actually do that and sort of reset the agenda. But what makes this story interesting isn't just Diageo's results. It's that this might, it's really what it might mean for the entire drinks industry. Because as we were saying, for the past 15, 20 years or so, the industry has been telling itself a very comforting story, which is consumers will simply keep trading up forever.
Yes, and I have opinions about this.
Oh, really? You've listed opinions? So I look forward to hearing those. But just to sort of start off with some data. So let's ground ourselves in some data. The picture is starting to wobble slightly. So according to IWSR, global beverage alcohol volume has declined about 1% in 2025, although overall value kind of held up because consumers were still buying, you know, a little bit more premium, a bit more expensive.
Yeah. So the so-called less but better phenomenon where people buy fewer drinks, but they spend more on the drinks they're having.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But even there, the momentum is slowing. And I guess that's what Sir Dave, is referring to in Diageo. So IWSR now predicts global spirit volumes to decline slightly in the near term, driven largely by weaker demand in both the US and China.
I think we can just call him drastic, actually.
Okay, we'll just call him drastic.
Okay, so what are the two biggest engines of premium spirits growth?
Okay, a good example is what we've seen recently in tequila. Probably the clearest example is tequila in the US. So for years, tequila has been the superstar category of premiumization, particularly in the US, but actually, you know, starting to see it in other markets as well. Ultra premium tequila grew at extraordinary rates over the last decade, fueled by brands like Don Julio and Casamigos, both owned by Diageo.
So I guess that growth is slowing too.
Yeah, exactly. Quite sharply, actually. So US industry data shows tequila sales growth is really slowing significantly in 2024 and again in 2025, particularly at these higher price tiers as consumers push back against repeated price increases. So some premium brands have reported kind of double-digit volume declines after years of explosive growth.
Yeah, which is quite a come down for what was supposed to be, you know, the unstoppable category.
Yeah, exactly. And analysts are starting to say that the tequila boom may simply just kind of run out of consumer spending power. Excuse me. So one analyst in Market Watch put it rather bluntly recently, where they said the US consumer simply can't keep absorbing price increases at the same rate.
That's right, because they've got pressurized consumer wallets.
Yeah, exactly, which is where Lewis's strategy is coming from. You're still laughing at pressurised wallets, aren't you?
What a ridiculous corporate example of corporate speak, a pressurised consumer wallet. Yeah.
Okay, you tell it like it is, Felicity. Yes. Why don't you? Yeah, we can always rely on you for that.
I'm an enemy of drastic Dave.
Yes. Okay, let's get us back on track, Felicity.
Yeah, sorry.
Because, yes, come on. Because what he is effectively telling investors is that Diageo needs to rebuild its presence in the middle market, which is, you know, where people have been trying to move out of proactively for the last 5 years. So I guess that means putting more focus on brands such as Smirnoff, Gordon's, Captain Morgan, you know, kind of the workhorses in the portfolio.
So it's back to basics for Drastic Dave.
Precisely. And Lewis Drastic Dave, has also suggested that Diageo needs to think more about categories rather than just brands. So in other words, looking at category entry points.
There it is, how, the first appearance in the podcast.
Got it in there. So how consumers actually enter and shop the category, Felicity.
If he used that language, do you think he's been listening to our podcast?
He might have been. I don't know. I can neither confirm nor deny that the Diageo strategy team listens to this podcast.
Yeah, well, if they do, where's our Bailey's sponsorship? That's what I want to know.
Oh, yeah, which you have been banging on about for quite a few episodes. Right. So we're still waiting. Anyway, so Diageo has fallen on harder times.
Yeah,
so wait until Drastic Dave's strategy starts to work, and then I'm sure we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah, but to be serious just for a second,
and then I'll go
back to being me. This is not just Diageo. The entire alcohol category is under this kind of pressure. Mm. Though, I must say, finding out that 60% of their orders are entered by hand, I think they have a very specific problem they need to overcome.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. That's right. And consumers are under economic pressure. Am I allowed to say that?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Moderation trends are growing, and in some markets, particularly amongst younger consumers, alcohol consumption is declining. Although Lewis himself has suggested the bigger issue really now is simply one of disposable income.
Yeah, okay. So the big question is where this leaves premiumization as a strategy.
Yeah, so I guess is this the beginning of something more structural? Because premiumization has been the central narrative, hasn't it, of drinks industry for, well, at least 10 years, if not more.
Yeah, it's such an attractive proposition for producers. You know, you just keep getting more expensive, and everyone tells you it's a great plan. No wonder everyone did it.
Yeah, kind of almost too simple, because historically alcohol behaves like most other consumer good categories. You know, when times are good, people trade up, and when times are tight, they trade down.
Yeah, and there's another thing, which is what a friend of mine once said, which is when everybody raises their prices at once, it's not premiumization, it's inflation.
Yeah, a very wise friend. Yes, because for years the industry has behaved as if the middle of the market kind of didn't really exist, but most consumers, most of us, kind of live there in the middle of the market.
I think this is why RTDs have taken off, to be honest. They're all about price point, not just convenience or taste.
Yeah, that's such a good point. So Lewis's message to investors is essentially this: Diageo needs to rebuild competitiveness at more accessible price points. And that's quite a shift in tone from the industry messaging that we were just talking about.
Yeah. So the message has been just keep climbing that ladder.
Exactly. And what Lewis is now saying politely, well, or bluntly, is that you eventually run out of ladder.
That's right. It gets wobbly.
Yeah, and when the world's largest spirits company starts talking about affordability in the middle market, the rest of the industry tends to listen. So to help illustrate this, Felicity, I've got my favourite framework handy.
Are we doing red corner, blue corner? Haven't we slightly overused that?
We'll never have overused it. And yes, it's perfect for this situation.
Go on, Luli.
Oh, thank you. Okay. You're humouring me. So if we look at this from a red corner perspective, the argument is that premiumisation may simply have just pushed too far. Prices rose quickly, consumers are under pressure, and the industry may now be rediscovering that people actually buy drinks somewhere in the middle price ladder.
Okay, fair enough. So what's the blue corner argument?
Okay, so this says premiumisation isn't ending, it's simply slowing down after an extraordinary decade of growth. Consumers will still trade up for the right drink, the right brand, and at the right occasion.
Yeah, and he didn't at any point suggest that Diageo should cull any of its premium brands. No. He said that there were other sectors they were ignoring.
Yeah, that's right. And if one strategy becomes, I guess, the only strategy, you probably start ignoring quite a large part of the market.
Yeah, and this actually brings me to my quite serious point about premiumisation. Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, is it a rant?
Yeah, it's a bit of a rant, to be honest.
Okay, go. Go.
Okay, so it's something a bit different, actually. It's been something I've been looking into, which is the premiumisation story that everybody's telling themselves may actually have been masking decline.
Oh, okay. So where are you going with this one then?
Okay, so premiumisation can actually be a way to make up for a shrinking consumer base. So if fewer people are drinking, or they're drinking less, but they spend more per drink, your revenues hold up and everything looks healthy financially. And so you might not actually notice that the market is shrinking.
Okay, so do you have an example of this? I think I may want to see some evidence.
Yeah, I think beer is a really good example. So okay. About 10 to 15 years ago, you got the rise of craft beer at roughly the same time that you get the inexorable decline of mainstream lagers, and it happened in the UK, Europe and the US simultaneously. Now craft beer is slipping and premium beers are rising, but the mainstream volumes haven't recovered.
Okay, so how does that work? So most of the big beer companies weren't in craft beer, so they couldn't have been pushing it as a substitute.
No, you're absolutely right. And I'm not suggesting they did. It's just that okay. If you were a beverage analyst and you looked at the beer market, you'd think, nothing to see here, everybody's trading up. But the bottom was falling out. And so profits were still high, but the bottom was actually falling out of it.
Okay, that's a really interesting take. Can you give us another example?
Yeah, I think wine is a really good example. So economics would say when times get tougher, people should just trade down because that's what typically happens. But that's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is a massive loss of the commercial end of the wine sector, with vineyards being pulled out of at scale in most of the most commercial regions like the Riverland in Australia. Yeah, so I think that tells you that the premiumization really was masking decline in the wine market.
Okay. So in spirits, though, it's different because all the action lately has been at the what we could call the affordable end, so the RTDs, as you just mentioned.
And I don't want to suggest that premiumization wasn't a good strategy at a particular time. My bigger point is that in chasing the premium dollars, marketers might not have noticed fundamental shifts that were happening in the market. And that's why I think we should keep our eye on the Diageo story to see if Drastic Dave is right, that there really is a segment of the market that's being ignored, because there might not be. And there might be lessons for other categories in that. You know, it might find that the high volume brands don't work anymore and they have to develop something else for middle. So I think it'll be a really interesting case study.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe this is a good time to turn to our second story, which is at the other end of the drinks spectrum, because while Diageo is worrying about whether consumers can still afford $45 for a bottle of spirits, another brand has been booming by doing something almost completely different, and that brand is Beatbox.
Oh, yeah, that is a success story and a half. I mean, it starts with a really great name. It just sort of screams, take me to a party.
Yeah, exactly. And apparently it's worked rather well because Beatbox is actually one of the fastest growing alcohol brands in the US.
Yeah. Do you want to explain what it is and where it comes from, Lily?
Yeah. Oh, okay. I get to do the history bit. Well, mini history bit. Anyway, so it started as a small Austin, Texas startup founded in 2011 by three students at the University of Texas. So basically selling brightly coloured, fruit flavoured, alcoholic party punch in cartons.
Yeah. And then they got national attention 2014 because they appeared on Shark Tank, you know, that investment. Television show, where investor Mark Cuban put in about $1 million for a third of the company. And it was one of the biggest deals in the show's history.
Yeah, and he certainly made some good money out of it since subsequently being a shareholder. So yes, because since then, the growth has been extraordinary. So the company has expanded in all 50 states with products now sold in roughly 140,000 stores, and retail sales in the US have recently passed $300 million a year.
Yeah, it's not bad for something that looks like it belongs fair and square to music festival and not many other places.
which to be fair is exactly where it gets sold. So if our listeners have never seen it, so basically imagine a sort of brightly coloured juice carton, 500 mils, tetra, covered in neon graphics. And they come in flavours like orange blast, juicy mango, and wait for it, blue raspberry. And yes, the blue.
Is it raspberry or is it raspberry?
It's raspberry.
It's double Z.
It's a double Z and it is bright blue.
God. You know, there's so many blue drinks around, and it makes me think the drinks designers had a fascination with the drain cleaners when they were children. Where does this come from?
The colour of this one, it kind of suggests that it may once have been used to clean swimming pools.
So all of these founders grew up in houses that had swimming pools. This is the takeaway. And does it taste like it?
I can neither confirm nor deny again, possibly, but what's interesting, let's get to the serious point, is like what's really interesting about Beatbox is how flexible the product is. So BeatBox is not precious about what's actually inside the box. So some versions are wine-based, wine being the sort of the alcohol. Some are malt-based, so like RTDs, malt in beer. But also the alcohol levels range from about 6% to about 11% ABV. So what they do is they'll change the formula depending on the state they're selling it in.
Yeah, because the US actually acts less like a country, more like multiple states when it comes to, you know, selling liquor. So you actually can launch different products into different states if you're creatively inclined. And obviously they did.
Yeah, exactly. So in some states, for example, they sell the wine-based versions through liquor stores, where in other states that's not legal. But in other states, if it's malt-based, you can potentially put it into convenience if it's at a certain ABV level. So basically what they're doing is taking the legislation in each state and looking at how do they adapt the product to make sure that it gets into the most convenience sort of side of the market and routes to market to reach their final customer.
Yeah, so what we're coming up with is BeatBox is fundamentally about flexibility.
Yeah. It tells us something about the kind of strategic mindset of the brand, doesn't it? Which is it's not about prestige and heritage. It's about routes to market, accessibility and category entry points, Felicity.
You can't stop yourself, can you? You just have to throw that in. But you haven't said mental availability yet. So.
Oh, damn, I've missed that one. It's like buzzword bingo on every episode, isn't it? When you score the card. Anyway, back to category entry points. So BeatBox is essentially built around exactly that idea, being present where people start drinking on a night out. So leading into festivals, parties, and I was just talking about convenience stores. And crucially, it's price point as well. So they sell for around $4 to $5 a carton. So they sit very firmly in the accessible end of the market.
Right. I have a special insight into this.
Oh, tell us.
Okay, so on my other podcast, Drinks Insider, I interviewed Ed Mundy, who is the beverage analyst for Jefferies Bank. Mm-hmm. And he said that what BeatBox and other successes like Buzzballs have in common is that they sell for a dollar a unit, more or less.
Okay, repeat that bit for me. So it's a dollar a unit. That doesn't make sense because they sell for more.
This is in units of alcohol, right? So depending on where you are in the world, a unit of alcohol is about 8 to 10 grams. And I don't know why they measure it in grams, but they do.
Okay,
So BeatBox, depending on which version you're drinking, is about 11% alcohol by volume. And it comes in a 500ml Tetra Pak that's sold for about $5, all right? When you break it down, that means that it's about 90 cents per unit of alcohol, or in other words, it's about 90 cents a drink, which makes it a lot cheaper than beer.
Okay, so I'll have to trust your maths on that. But it's quite a contrast with the premium spirits world we were just discussing. And I want to point out something else. It's a mixed drink when in many parts of the industry, mixing drinks is treated kind of almost as sort of borderline heresy.
Yeah, which is funny considering how much the RTD craze has taken off. But you're right. There are whole categories built on the idea that the product must be consumed in a very particular way.
Okay, Felicity. So this reminds me of a recent drinks experience that we've had here in Belize on my sabbatical.
Now we come to it. Okay, so is this a cocktail-based anecdote?
Sort of.
Yeah, go on. Tell us about your experience in Belize on your sabbatical.
Okay, so tangent time very, very quickly. So as you know, and our listeners probably do because I bang on about it, I am a whiskey drinker, as is my husband. So in the supermarkets in Belize, the whiskey and fairly kind of mediocre whiskey, Scotch, sells for over $150 US a bottle for pretty standard stuff. But the local rum is about $15 US a bottle. Now, my husband is, shall we say, budget conscious.
So he's suffering from a pressurised consumer wallet, is he?
Yes, his consumer wallet is pressurised.
Okay, so back to the rum.
Okay, so he bought the local rum with his pressurised wallet, which was very nice, but too sweet for us. So I went back to the supermarket with my less pressurised wallet and bought some whiskey because I'm not as tight as him. But now he's mixing the two together.
So it's just like a tropical Negroni, except nothing like a Negroni.
Yeah, and apparently he's called it risky. Get it? Whiskey, risky.
Why don't you just stick to gin and tonics like normal people? All right, well, so how does it taste?
In a can from Lidl.
In a can from Lidl. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
All the cool kids are doing. I guess you don't have Lidl in Belize.
All right, so I'll forgive you. No. Okay. Yeah, well, how does it taste? So I think he's mainly drinking it to prove a point that his rum purchase was a good idea and not to admit that it wasn't and that his wallet is too tight. But actually, it tastes quite nice. But I guess the reason for admitting this is the idea of getting too caught up in category traditions that can sometimes be a real barrier for drinks companies.
But the thing is, do you think that these drinks are very different from mixers in the past? I mean, the idea of being like super flexible and running out a different one for different states and so on is very interesting and a triumph of modern logistics, I guess. But we have had mixers in the past.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, but if we're thinking about Beatbox, I guess I just think it's this more flexible approach, particularly the alcohol content, you know, switching between wine based and malt based, and the formula changing, as you say, to enable routes to market. And that's why I think the Beatbox story is really important, because while one part of the industry is debating whether premiumization has gone too far, another part is growing very quickly by doing the opposite.
By going cheap and cheerful. Now, listen, before we finish with this, I have a special insight into Beatbox about how it's introduced Tetra Paks everywhere and you're going to see more of them.
Okay, go ahead. I'm interested because there have been many launches of Tetra Paks.
Yeah, it's never worked because it's always been assumed to be like the down and dirty end of the wine market. Mm. But this is about to change. And a number of wineries in California are about to start rolling them out and doing 200ml versions as well.
Okay. So you have a bad habit of saying things. So explain more. Give us more detail.
Okay. So what people have discovered about Beatbox is that the carton is resealable, right? It has a twist top on it. So that means people have discovered they can take it in their handbag or their backpack and they can open it and it won't spill the way an opened can would.
Yeah, and very importantly also, therefore, it can't be spiked either, which is particularly important, you know, primarily for female drinkers, not exclusively, but a really important point. So where are they taking it?
I'll just do a segue and say one of the other things about some of these drinks which are really popular, like Buzzballs, is they're single serve and nobody can tamper with it. This is a really important point that you've picked up. Anyway, so going back to the Tetra Pak, people are taking it everywhere. They're slipping it into their bags and they're taking it to sports venues or to the cinema. And apparently what you do is you buy a cup of water or something and then you toss it out or drink it or whatever. And then you pour what you really want to drink into your Coke cup and nobody can tell the difference.
Okay, this is where I have to do a minor confession of another story. Back many years ago, traveling for business with one of my colleagues, and we were in the US, and we were given some wine by one of our clients, which we wanted to have a glass of in the evening and sit outdoors, but you weren't allowed to drink in public. So we took the coffee cups from the takeout coffee cups from the hotel bedroom, filled them with ice, tipped some wine in, and sat outside drinking our coffee.
So you were early to this trend. But anyway, I heard about Wine Paris, and apparently Tetra Paks are on the way.
Okay, so you have the best trivia. And here was me thinking the real untapped opportunity was serving the unmet need for blue drinks,
well,
which I know are your favourite.
Well, many things can be true at once, Lily. Many things. Okay, and just to show you that Beatbox isn't the only one playing around with flavour, I would like to present you with a case of Jägermeister.
Ah, okay, the German spirit, the one they call the Jägerbomb.
That's right. So Jägermeister started out as a digestive for older male and pretty much blue-collar Germans. But then in the 1980s, an American importer called Sidney Frank took it to the States and promoted it to the youth and student market. He treated it like a party drink and in a very un-PC way.
Okay, so don't tell me it involved objectifying women?
Correct. Frank hired attractive women in branded outfits, which I'm sure were pretty skimpy, and got them to hand out free shots at the bar, a promotional tactic that the entire industry soon copied.
Yeah, so it grew its appeal, and particularly to young men, I take it.
Yes, correct. Again, the brand became the go-to for the under 25 male in both the UK and US markets in the early aughts. But this ended up being a problem. Guess what the problem was, Lily?
Core demographic grows out of it, and the next That's age right. group don't want to do what older people before them did.
Exactly. And this was a double problem for Jägermeister, because they'd tried to hold on to two identities at once. Mm. So on the one hand, they were a party drink, and on the other, they kept trying to keep their appeal to older drinkers using heritage cues.
Yeah, and how did that work out for them?
Well, in 2016, a Wharton professor by the spectacular name of Americus Reed told Marketplace that it was a, quote, dangerous strategy, because branding is all about, quote, telling a consistent message that resonates to a particular group of customers that you've defined as your target.
Which I would wholeheartedly agree with.
Yeah, but they actually seem to have managed it. And you would probably approve of what they've been doing lately, which is they've been focusing on consumer behaviour.
I do approve of that. So what have the results been for them?
Well, in 2025, global sales grew about 8%. And this, of course, is in a market where, you know, the big players like Diageo have been struggling.
Yeah, which is, that's super impressive, isn't it? So what's their secret then? Why are they exceeding the market?
So what they did was they launched a new product. They rolled out a new drink called Jägermeister Orange, described by the company as, quote, offering a light and fruity taste profile suited to mixing. And as of March 2026, they've sold more than 5 million bottles.
Okay, I have to admit, Jägermeister has never really been a drink that features heavily in my personal repertoire.
No, I've never actually had one, despite that they pop up every time I go to the supermarket. And I don't know why. It just doesn't feel like a drink that's aimed at me. So it did start as a traditional herbal liqueur, or what's called a Kräuterlikör, but it's very much associated in my mind with cheap drinking.
Yeah, excuse me. Yes, possibly not the brand positioning the founders originally had in mind. So the flavour extension that you were just talking about there, it sounds like it's been a huge kind of a success for them, sort of untapped market for the fruit flavour generally.
Yeah, and in Germany, Austria and the Czech Republic, which of course is their, you know, home ground, the launch has been described as one of the most successful spirits introductions of the past decade.
Very impressive. So innovation that actually responds to how people drink, rather than just sort of launching endless new SKUs, which often happens. So while supporting the core brand, but the risk with spirits innovation is that you can also dilute that core brand.
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting here is the fact that they've maintained these two parallel brand identities at once, and they seem to have managed it. I mean, maybe, I don't know how they've done it, maybe by offering different faces of the brands in different international markets, or just maybe by partitioning very clearly about, you know, we're going to sell it like this way to one very defined group and sell it like this to another very defined group. I don't know, but it's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interestingly, when you look at this story, so the Jägermeister story alongside the two other stories that we've already discussed today.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's interesting.
Yeah. So on the one hand, we have Diageo questioning whether the industry has pushed premiumization a little too far.
Yeah. And then you've got Beatbox, which is the complete opposite. So low prices, flexible products, and absolutely zero concern about tradition.
Yeah, exactly. And then we've got Jägermeister showing that a smart innovation inside a strong brand can still drive growth even when the broader spirits market is struggling.
Yeah, and I'll just note on that idea that Dave Lewis is talking about it going for the middle of the market. So he's not talking about the bottom of the market, he's talking about the middle. The Jägermeister Orange, I calculated, comes out to be about $2.60 a unit of alcohol, which makes it quite expensive relative to Beatbox. But the normal Jägermeister is almost exactly $1 a unit.
That's incredible. So it's almost three times in terms of price for dollar per unit of alcohol between the two SKUs of Jägermeister.
Yeah, that's
you're
right.
Saying.
But it wouldn't come anywhere close to one of the premium brands of Diageo. So, you know, maybe it's functioning as a treat. I don't know.
Yeah. So in its own way, it's sort of the orange extension is a premium product relative to the competitors or to
that's
its
right.
core brand.
And so I predict the next one will be a Dubai chocolate version.
Yes. Right, Felicity, any more observations?
No, I think we've been through the world of drinks pretty thoroughly for now, but I'm off to Provine soon, so I'm sure I will come back bearing a whole lot of brand new ranty opinions.
That's what we are relying on you for. I can't wait for that. And if listeners have questions or stories they'd like us to discuss in future episodes, you can always email us at aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. And as always, I will read them.
Now, before we go, I have a very important question to ask you, Luli.
Okay.
By the time we record the next one, will you finally be back in your home office?
No, Felicity.
Really? Why is that?
I'll still be on sabbatical.
Your non-stop research tour of tropical paradises.
Yes, and I solemnly promise to keep doing important field research in bars and supermarkets wherever I happen to be.
Luli, you are nothing if not dedicated.
Now somebody's got to do it, Felicity.
You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send us any questions you'd like us to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you reviewing and rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.